Welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. Joining us this afternoon is Scott Harrington, the Alan B. Miller Professor of Healthcare Management and Professor of Insurance and Risk Management at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Scott, thanks very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Paul.
Scott, we're in a brave new world now, and I know you've written quite a bit about this and about the insurance regulations surrounding the new healthcare legislation. After a year of bitter partisan wrangling and debate, healthcare reform, let's call it Obamacare just for short, has become the law of the land. One of the central components of the legislation is the mandate that all American citizens purchase health insurance or pay a penalty. There are also provisions that require insurance companies to charge one price called community rating within certain bounds. I think you can vary it by up to a factor of three based on age and guaranteed issue, which means they cannot turn away anyone because of a pre-existing condition, and that starts beginning in 2014. Could you talk just for a few minutes about the logic behind these provisions or how they all fit together, why they were all put in the legislation? And then is there an example, perhaps in Massachusetts, where very similar regulations are in effect now, we could talk about that would give us some sense about how these regulations, how these new laws are apt to play out once they take effect?
Sure. The logic about the connection, I think you really have to go to the idea of trying to prevent health insurers from denying coverage based on pre-existing conditions or imposing coverage exclusions for pre-existing conditions or even rating on health status. Once you have the mindset that you don't want an insurance company to be able to charge a higher rate for someone who's not in good health, or that you don't want them to be able to selectively exclude a condition, and this is for someone who doesn't have insurance in the past and is just applying for insurance for the first time without any prior coverage. Once you want to have a world where insurance companies have to offer that person a coverage at so-called standard rates, you run into the thorny problem of how to try to avoid people simply waiting until they need health care to apply for the insurance. Because if they don't face any penalty in terms of not being able to get coverage for certain conditions or not facing a higher price, there can be pretty strong incentives just to do nothing and wait until something serious happens and then buy coverage, especially for people with low to moderate incomes. So that then gets to the issue of, if you want to have a world with this quasi-community rating where you may allow some limited variation in health insurance premiums by age but don't allow pricing based on health status or coverage based on health status, it makes the case for having some sort of a mandate so that you can compel people to buy insurance before they think they're going to need expensive health care. So that's how logically the major parts fit together. If you didn't have the strong emphasis on not allowing an insurance company to charge more for people that wait to get coverage, then there wouldn't be the pressure for the mandate. Of course, as the law turned out, the mandate is really relatively weak, because the financial penalties for not complying with coverage, even after they're fully phased in, are not going to be very large compared to the price of insurance coverage for many buyers.
So unpack that for a moment. So we start out with a situation where we think we're trying to be compassionate, and we say, okay, insurance companies are going to have to cover all comers, and the amount that they can charge all comers, which means, you know, even people who apply with pre-existing conditions, is going to be fairly narrow. So we start out with that act of compassion, but then it turns out that if you're young and healthy, this is going to drive up rates for you in the market now that insurers have to cover all these sicker people, and leading to this concern of adverse selection, which is people can make a rational decision not to get insurance coverage until they're sick, because the price that faces them is not going to change. You can buy it when you're healthy, you can buy it when you're sick, but if you're facing the same price, you might as well wait until you get sick. Is that pretty much a correct summary?
Yeah, that's a correct summary. And if you did have a strong mandate, as you alluded to, you're basically then in the situation where you're mandating that younger and healthy people basically pay much higher premiums than they would in a regular marketplace. If they do have good health, they pay a much higher premium in order to subsidize people that are less healthy. So there's an implicit tax embedded in the idea, even if you have an enforceable mandate with strong penalties. If you don't have strong penalties, then you get the problem of people waiting nonetheless, which will drive up the cost of coverage.
So, and what you have pointed out in a number of articles you've written is that right now what we've got is a weak mandate. We've got a weak mandate at the federal level in Obamacare. We've got a weak mandate in Massachusetts, where it does appear that people have made exactly the kind of decision you've just posited for them, which is they're saying, look, I'm going to wait until I'm sick to get coverage or I need medical care. and insurance rates have actually gone up there. That what the insurers have said is that typically people are joining up for just a few months and incurring very heavy medical expenses for a few months and then dropping coverage again. Is that the way you think it's likely to play out in the federal legislation when that takes effect as well?
In Massachusetts, I think we can wait to get more data, but certainly the anecdotes have been that you've had some evidence of the type of churning that you've described, of people basically either waiting and then buying or buying and then dropping after they incur health expenses, which has contributed to the cost increase. It's yet to be determined how severe the problem is in Massachusetts, because you have such a large proportion of the population that's getting coverage at work and a large proportion is getting it basically through the Medicaid program. I think we face a serious risk that we can have severe problems on that dimension under the reforms, assuming if we don't have any kind of repeal and replace. It'll depend to some extent on the regs that are imposed and the way that the penalties that are there are actually enforced. The talk recently about whether or not there will be enforcement, I mean, some people have tried to be getting people to believe that there basically won't be an enforcement, that the IRS isn't going to go after you if you don't pay the penalty and all that. If that type of talk translates into reality, it would encourage even more people not to comply with the mandate. The exact effects are difficult to predict because of the nature of the subsidies, but I think if you look at sort of examples of people that might have salaries of $50,000 to $60,000 a year, that there are going to be situations where if they don't have any dependents, it could be quite sensible for them not to pick up coverage, or even in some cases, if they do have dependents, just to wait. And we will see upward pressure on premiums. And the other thing that will happen, I think we tend to forget, is the mandate itself, there will be different levels of coverage that will be permitted, but there will be a minimum level of required coverage. And the overall expansion of health insurance, including having insurance policies that will cover in many cases more than what people currently insure, by itself is going to produce strong upward pressure on costs, which will make premiums go up, which then in conjunction with this adverse selection problem where young people tend to wait and pay the penalty if they're forced to pay the penalty, could really lead to a cost surge, which will make the system, I think, pretty unstable and lead to a lot of controversy about what insurance companies are trying to charge for the coverage as their costs go up.
And this is, and I think you're absolutely right, this is a very complicated question, not really sure how it's going to play out in terms of, if I understand it correctly, the legislation basically mandates something a lot closer to employer style or employer richness of benefits for individual insurance coverage, a much richer benefit package, which is going, as you said, going to drive up costs. And then at the same time, the federal government's also empowered to review rate increases. And the president and Governor Patrick in Massachusetts have done their fair share of insurance company bashing lately. But those rate increases that are being faced by individuals or businesses are being driven by underlying costs. This is not just insurance companies gouging people to pad their profits.
That's the case. I think what is going on in Massachusetts could be a foretaste of things to come in other states, if not nationwide. Basically, you've got most of the leading health insurers in Massachusetts are nonprofits. They've had a steady decline in their profitability since the Massachusetts reforms went into effect. They need significant rate increases, and you've got really the posturing that's taking place where the governor is saying we're not going to permit this, and you've had the companies try to forestall it in court, but now it'll work its way through the administrative system, and then there'll be legal challenges. And this is not out of the question. It's not out of the question that this could happen in quite a few states, or could even become the norm once this law were to kick in, because the political pressure will be enormous when health insurance is expensive and it becomes more expensive, in part due to the increased utilization from broader coverage, in part due to the adverse selection. The political response will be to try to roll back the tide and basically say, we're not going to allow those rate increases. This has got something to do with these greedy private sector insurance companies. And I think what you'll end up with, at least in some markets, is very strong pressure to basically have some form of additional government intervention, whether it be the form of a state insurer or a national public option. The worst case scenario here, I think, is one where costs increase quite a bit due to the mandate, due to adverse selection. Then we have these controversies about rate increases. We basically have the government prohibit rate increases on some dimension. And then you have the call for displacing the private sector, which basically won't be able to write at the rates that the government will permit, and will end up down the road with much greater centralization of health insurance coverage and coverage decisions by the federal government.
Last question. Have you given some thought to it? And you just pointed out this is extraordinarily complex. Lots of things are going to play out, and I can easily see the scenario that you just described playing out, which is insurers are caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of they're seeing higher costs. They, you know, for political reasons, they're not going to be allowed to increase rates. It's going to lead to all sorts of unanticipated consequences in the market. Insurers could stop offering coverage. They could push down on provider prices, which will lead to access problems. But given the fact that we're in this framework, we're living in this world now, as you pointed out, we've got exchanges. There's at least going to be this impossibility of HSAs, health savings accounts available. I know they're legal under the law. We'll see how they're actually implemented. But is there a way to take the framework of this and, you know, you said reform or replace earlier in the conversation. Is there a way to reform this where it would make more market sense and would drive some of the reforms in a more market-oriented direction in terms of controlling costs and at the same time expanding coverage in a responsible way?
Well, I think there are two issues there. One is, given the current structure in the bill, what might be done to make it work as well as possible in terms of trying to preserve a market incentives and incentives for cost control? And then the other one is, if we could take legislative action to modify the bill without a full repeal, what kind of things might be done? I think the first question is difficult, because a lot of what will happen will depend on regs. But I think, as a general rule, what we should try to work for under the existing legislation is to try to make sure that regulations are developed to really emphasize and preserve state and regional flexibility, so that we don't end up having a system where, under some mechanism, the different state or regional exchanges basically are taking orders from Washington and we have a centralized system. As part of that, to the extent that the regs that are developed can allow for maximum flexibility for insurance companies that sell through the exchange, they'll be constrained by the legislation in terms of the broad types of plans they can provide regarding actuarial standards and so on. But there's still a lot of room for flexibility in plan design, and it's very important to try to ensure that the regs that come out do permit the flexibility, especially at the lower cost plans, so that we can have a viable health savings account market, so that people that choose to do so can buy high deductible plans and satisfy the law, and then we'll get the nice incentives that can flow from having consumers have more skin in the game when it comes to their health care. I think also, in terms of regs, ultimately, once we've got these exchanges, there will be government oversight and attention will be paid to coverage decisions by insurance companies. Right now, we have a lot of private contracting that takes place where insurance companies decide what to cover in terms of experimental treatment or expensive new treatments. We'll have to figure out a way going forward how those decisions will be made, and it's very important to try to preserve some degree of decentralization so that we don't end up, through the new health insurance reform, basically having some centralized federal agency dictating what each and every insurance company, the specific types of treatments that it will have to cover. Then I don't know what we can do, but to try to preserve flexibility in ratings so that we don't gravitate towards a system where basically the regulators at the state level are telling insurance companies what they can charge. And then two other things I think that have kind of not been on the radar screen, but in the long run, if this bill goes into effect, we're going to face the issue ultimately of how is it going to affect the large employer group market? Because at least for the short-term future after the law takes effect, the majority of the public will still be getting their health insurance through large employer plans. And the issue arises as to how the grandfathering will work. And right now, the legislation basically says that large plans have to do certain things, extend coverage to kids till they're age 25 and so on. But they're not required to meet the coverage requirements under the exchange that will apply to the exchanges. But the law says that if employer plans change, if they change the design of the plan, they'll basically become subject to the rules of the exchange. And the regs that are put into effect that will determine the scope of changes that large employer plans can make without being subject to the regulatory regime that applies to the exchange will be pretty important. If you have a tight system, then over a matter of time, large employers basically will be forced, if they want to make changes, to abide by the rules of the exchange. And at that point, we've basically extended that whole regulatory apparatus to the large employer groups. And at that point, basically everything will be subject to those rules. The other thing I think could be very important, but it's hard to see how they could be worked into regulations, but it might be possible without legislative action. It would be very desirable to have some sort of penalty that's developed for people that violate the mandate and then wait to buy coverage. Now, maybe this can be done through restrictions on open enrollment, where there would only be a week or two a year where a person could sign up for coverage on a guaranteed issue basis. Maybe the regs could be tweaked in ways where there could be some form of waiting period, or at least temporary waiting period, before people could get coverage. But the big issue there is, without some mechanism that penalizes people ex post if they wait, this adverse selection problem we've been talking about could be quite severe. Again, it's not clear to me what can be done along those lines just through regulation. I think if we go to the second big question of how can you modify this thing without a basic replace and repeal, I would want to target the mandate and get rid of the mandate, and then also have meaningful penalties for people that fail to buy coverage, so that they simply wouldn't be able to get guaranteed issue coverage at a standard rate if they waited. Instead, there'd be some mechanism where there would be waiting periods or premium surcharges or exclusions of some pre-existing conditions for a limited period of time, so that you could basically have a system that could be functional without forcing people to buy health insurance against their will, but then having them face some penalty if they wait until they get sick to try to avail themselves of some sort of subsidy or coverage in general.
You're trying to recognize, I think, a fundamental, you know, American value. You don't want coercion in these matters of health, but at the same time, you want to prevent people from free riding on the system and passing on their costs to others when they do get sick.
Yes, and I think with the longer-term and shorter-term budget outlook, it's very difficult to justify having enacted this program at the present time. But apart from the budget crisis that we face, I think many people would be somewhat amenable, even conservatives would be somewhat amenable to having a system of modest subsidies for people with low income in a voucher-type framework, where they could go out and get some assistance in buying health insurance subject to certain income thresholds. But the idea of then coupling that with a mandate that basically says we're going to force people of low to modest means, regardless of whether they get a subsidy or regardless of the amount of subsidy, to buy coverage, I have difficulties with philosophically. But also the problem is that you have to mandate something, and that takes you down this slippery slope to having the government involved in coverage design, deductible choices, premium rates, and eventually determining what insurance companies will have to pay for individual procedures, and that's just basically some form of national healthcare system by a different name.
Right. As Henry Ford once quipped, you can have any color car you want as long as it's black. So you can have any insurance policy you want as long as it's exactly the one specified to you by the federal government. Scott, thank you very much for your time and your illuminating comments today.
All right. My pleasure, Paul. Thanks.